Thanks a lot. First, to the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here and for organizing such a wonderful conference. It's always a pleasure to be back at PI. I'm going to talk about the work that we did together with Giuseppe Policastro at Ecole Normale and his student, Dong Sheng Ge, that tries to study how the presence of defects influence the complexity of states. And I should say before I start that this question was actually suggested to me by Davide over lunch here at PI. We were very happy to find interesting things there, so thanks. All right, so that's the outline of my talk. Since I know that most people here don't do complexity or entanglement, I thought it was a good idea to start with a rather broad overview of complexity. So I will start by telling you what's the definition of complexity and what are the properties that we expect it to have. And then I will tell you a little bit what we know about it in quantum field theory and about the two holographic proposals. The second part of my talk is going to be about our result, about the study of complexity for two-dimensional defect CFTs. And I will start by explaining the setup, which is a thin ADS2 brain embedded in ADS3. I will tell you what we learned about the complexity of defects for the full boundary state and for subregions as well. And I will finally describe a little bit of results in free, very simple bosonic free defect field theory model. All right, so that's the overview part. And first thing first, I want to start with the definition. So I want to tell you what is quantum computational complexity. That's the our main player in this talk. So quantum computational complexity is a property of quantum states, which basically is defined as the minimal number of elementary, simple unitary operations that need to be applied in order to build a given state, a given state of interest, and starting from an unentangled product state. So basically, it's trying to tell us how hard it is to build the state for a quantum computer. And let me break it down for a simple example of a spin chain. So the idea is that we start with a simple unentangled product state. For example, for a chain of n spins, that could be a state in which all the spins are pointing up. This is what we will call our reference state. And we will start applying simple gates taken from a universal set. That means that they allow us to get as close as we want to any state that we want. And one example of such universal state is in the box over there. And of course, we have to include not only one gates that act on a single spin, but also gates that act on more than one spin in order to introduce entanglement into the system and go out of the product state. And the task is to approximate the state of interest, which we call the target state, with this unitary operation built from the gates by building what's called a quantum circuit, so a sequence of these gates. Now, I should say that when talking about spin chain, often we are talking about discrete gate sets. And so we cannot really reach whatever state we want. We can only get as close as we want. And so a part of the definition of complexity is to introduce a tolerance, how close we want to get to our target state. And complexity is then going to be the minimal number of gates which are required to perform this task. And the definition of complexity, as you see, depends on the various choices that I make, on the reference state, on the gates, and so on, and on the tolerance. And the way we should think about it is that complexity is a family of measures. It's not a single measure. It's a family of measures that depend on all those choices. Now, all this discussion was about complexity of states, but in a very similar way, we can talk about complexity of unitary transformations so that move us between, between states. And we can ask what's the minimal number of gates which are needed in order to construct a given unitary, and that discussion will follow very similarly to the discussion about states. So that's the definition. And now I want to tell you a little bit what we know about the properties of complexity and how we can use complexity to study quantum mechanical systems. And the way that we tie the concept of complexity to a particular quantum mechanical system is that we focus on the complexity of a particular unitary operator, which is the time evolution. And As holographer, we are particularly interested in systems that are called fast scramblers. These are systems that spread the effects of perturbations, localized perturbation, over all the degrees of freedom of the system in a time which is logarithmic in the entropy. For example, Hamiltonians on the right, on the spin chain, for a generic choice of the couplings J, are going to be fast scramblers, unless the couplings are tuned specially. And we can do a number of counting arguments to show that the complexity should follow the following pattern as the complexity of this unitary as a function of time. So it's expected to grow linearly for an exponential amount of time, so for a very, very long time. Then it reaches a maximal value, which is exponential in the number of degrees of freedom, for example, in the spin chain, in the number of the spins. Then it will fluctuate around this maximal value, and due to Poincaré recurrence effects, at some point, it has to track back down. All right, so that's about spin chains. And the next thing I want to do is I want to tell you what we know about complexity in quantum field theory. But in order to do that, I need to go out of this discrete language of the gates and move to a more continuous language, which is adapted better to study problems in field theory. So that's what Nielsen did for us. Nielsen translated the problem of identifying the optimal circuits to a problem of to a geometric problem of studying geodesics on the group manifold where the unitaries live. When talking about spin chain, this group manifold where the unitary lives is SU2 to the n. And the basic idea is that the elementary generators of SU2 to the n, which are generalized, basically products of Pauli matrices, form a representation of this group. And we can use the different generators to move in different directions in the group. And what Nielsen proposed was a metric which will be associated with these motions. In this way, we study continuous trajectories rather than discrete ones. And we can make all our requirements, for example, the requirement that gates are simple, acting on a small number of qubits, by penalizing certain directions of motion in this metric. And as I said, this allows to translate the question of finding the optimal trajectories or the optimal circuits to that of finding minimal geodesics in just a very large space. Of course, this problem is not always easy to solve, but it's very easy to define for spin chains, for example. All right, so now let me tell you how this can be used in quantum field theory. So this approach was generalized by Roe Jefferson and Rob Myers to quantum field theories. And what they did was they tried to evaluate the complexity of the simplest state they could think of, which was the ground state of a free bosonic field theory. This one. And starting from an unentangled state, which is the ground state of an ultralocal Hamiltonian where the derivative term has been turned off. In this Hamiltonian, the different sides don't talk to each other, and so the ground state of this Hamiltonian will be unentangled. And the complexity, so basically that was the task. Now I should say that one challenge in defining the complexity in field theory is that the complexity in field theory, just like the entanglement entropy, is divergent because we need to establish correlation up to arbitrarily short length scale. And so one has to introduce a regulator, a lattice spacing or a momentum cutoff. And basically, that's what we obtain, or that's what they obtain for the complexity. That's the result. There is a structure of divergences, starting with a volume law counted in units of, say, the lattice spacing, which depends on this scale sigma ref. Sorry. Sigma ref, which is basically the scale of the reference state where we started. And there is an alternative approach based on the Fubini-Studi metric, which gives the same result. But what you should remember is basically that the complexity in these simple models follows a pattern of divergences in jumps of two in terms of the cutoff, and where the leading divergence depends on the reference scale. All right, so now I'm going to take a very big leap, and I'm going to move to holography. I'm going to tell you about two proposals that have been made for the holographic dual of complexity. Of course, the story started the other way around. I'm just telling it this way. The story started by two gravitational observables that were particularly interesting because they were probing the behind horizon region of black holes. But they were behaving a bit weird, for example, increasing for a very long time and so on, and people were looking for what could be their field theory dual. That's how we reached talking about complexity. So these are the two gravitational observables that are proposed as the dual of complexity. The first one is the complexity equals volume. The claim there is that the complexity is going to be dual to a maximal space-like slice anchored at the boundary time slice where the state is defined. That's going to be the complexity of the state. So basically take the volume and divide by some length scale that is needed in order to make the units work. And these are two examples. For example, this slice that we are going to compute to know the complexity of the vacuum, or the time slice, which we will evaluate to know the complexity of the thermofield double state, which is dual to an eternal black hole. The second proposal, which was suggested later, again, all this proposal by Saskind and the group at Stanford, is the complexity equals action proposal. And the claim there is that the complexity is equal to the gravitational action of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, which is a bulk domain of dependence of the bulk Cauchy slice anchored at the boundary state. So basically what we do is we take the time slice where the boundary state is defined and we send some light sheets into the bulk. We look at the region which is bounded by these light sheets, and that's what we call the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And the claim is that the gravitational action of this region will give us the complexity. It has some advantages in that it doesn't require introducing a length scale by hand or doesn't single out a special space-like slice. All right, so now you know the two proposals, so I should tell you why we think they are complexity. So we have a number of reasons to think that these two proposals are related to complexity. The first reason is qualitative, and is related to a proposal by Brian Swingle originally, that one can visualize and understand the pattern of entanglement in a quantum state by an emergent holographic direction, which is very similar to ADS. And in this picture, the number of gates is simply the geometric volume, and that's proposing the complexity equals volume proposal. Another reason why we think that's complexity is that these two observables admit a linear growth at late times for a very long time at a rate which is proportional to the energy of the system. So for example, these observables have been calculated in the thermofield double state, and since this maximal area surface basically becomes longer and longer inside the black hole, we see this linear growth. And this is to be contrasted with the evolution of entanglement entropy, which saturates much, much faster at a time which is of the order of the size of the region. And this means that when we talk about entanglement entropy, about Ryu Takayanagi surfaces, they don't penetrate behind the horizon of a black hole for such a long time. So this is what led Saskind and the group there to say that entanglement is not enough to understand the rich geometric structure that exists behind the horizon and which are predicted by general relativity. That's why we are so interested in these gravitational observables. The last motivation, which is the one I find the most convincing for why we think that these observables are complexity, are related to the effects of perturbations. And the idea here is that we can characterize the effect of perturbations on the complexity by introducing what's called the precursor operator, which includes a backward time evolution with a given Hamiltonian, of course, the insertion of a perturbation, and then a forward evolution. And that measures by how much the complexity of this operator is different from the complexity of the unit operator, is telling us how much the system was influenced by the perturbation. So when studying the complexity of these systems on spin chain, we expect to see basically a chaotic evolution, some kind of epidemic spreading exponential growth at early times. And then after the scrambling time, we expect to see a linear growth again. And that's exactly what you see by these gravitational observables. You can mimic the effect of perturbation by putting shock waves. And that's exactly what you will see. You will see an exponential growth with the Lyapunov exponent of maximally chaotic systems, followed by a delayed linear evolution after the scrambling time. All right, so after this review, having all this in mind, it's very natural to ask, what's the difference between the two proposals? So are they different in any sense? You already saw that in many cases, they give very, very similar results. For example, they give both a linear growth at late times at a rate which is proportional to the energy of the system. They both give similar reaction to perturbations. One more thing is that they both give a very similar structure of divergences. So this I'm going to explain. You remember that I said that one of the challenges in defining complexity in field theory was that the quantity was divergent because we needed to establish correlation up to very short length scales. And in holography, we have a similar effect. This is due to the region near the boundary since the metric blows up there. And so in order to regularize this quantity, we need to introduce a cutoff surface. Usually that's done at some value z equal delta in a Pfefferman-Gram expansion. And if you do the calculation, what you find is, for example, for vacuum ADS, that there is a series of divergences that start for both proposals with a volume law counted in units of the cutoff proportional to the central charge. And there is one difference is that when talking about the action, there is a dependence on an arbitrary scale, which is related to the normalization of null normals on the boundaries of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. And this dependence looks very similar to the way in which the choice of the reference state entered into the complexity in the field theory side. But in any event, we wanted to understand if there are cases where the two proposals are not equivalent or differ substantially, and that's what led us to study the complexity of defects. So I'm going to move to tell you next about the complexity of defects, but I'm going to stop first to ask if there are any questions. Right. So let me start by telling you what's the setup that we studied. The setup that we studied was a conformal defect in ADS3. You remember from Maddalena's talk that a conformal defect is a defect which preserves as much as possible from the symmetries in its absence. And in the case of a two-dimensional field theory, that's a defect which preserves one copy of the Virasoro algebra. And the model that we studied was this simple holographic model of an ADS2 brain embedded in ADS3 with the following, which solves basically the following action, which has the usual Einstein-Hilbert term, plus a term over here, which is basically a brain term with lambda detention of the brain. All right. So this action admits a solution, an exact solution, including back reaction, which looks like that. If we turn off the parameter y star, which encodes the tension of the brain, we get an action which is simply empty ADS. But with the brain tension turned on, we get an action which has a jump in the extrinsic curvature. And that's more. So let me explain a little bit more about the geometry. The geometry is foliated by slices of constant y, r, and t. The slices of constant y are slices of ADS2, and they are in the green, denoted in green. The slices of constant r are the geodesics in red, and plus there is a time direction. And what this solution tells us is basically that we take two slightly more than halves of ADS, and we sew them together at the location of the defect. So just to put things in context, this, of course, is not anything we invented. This model is originally due to a number of papers by Randall, Sundrum, and Karch. And it appears also more recently in the holographic literature by people studying ADS-BCFT proposal by Takayanagi and friends. And in particular, all those talks were on related geometries. Right, and I should say that our particular holographic models in ADS-3 was already studied by these people over here. And these people were trying to evaluate the boundary entropy, and they were just looking at Ryu Takayanagi surfaces that ended on the brain and basically looked at the constant shift in the entanglement entropy, which is the boundary entropy. All right, so let's start by evaluating the volume. So that's the first thing we did. We have a portion of the volume, which is the one in the usual part of ADS, plus a part of the volume which is in the extension. I already told you that we need to regularize, so we put a cutoff at z equals delta in the Pfefferman-Gram expansion, but in the defect region, we have to be a bit more careful. And so we are using a cutoff which is a constant geodesic in the defect region. That's nice because it connects smoothly across the defects, but of course, none of the, say, coefficients of the log or anything that is universal in the result will not depend on this choice. And that's what we get. So it shouldn't come as a surprise. Since we have more volume, we basically get a larger complexity from the volume proposal. We get a leading contribution, which is a volume law, proportional to the central charge. And then the effect of the defect is an extra logarithmic divergence, a shift by this tension parameter y star. And finally, there's also a topological contribution, which is this pi, which was addressed by these people over here. Right, and I should say that this Y star, the tension of the brain, is also observed, again, in the Affleck-Ludwig boundary entropy when evaluating the entanglement entropy of regions which are centered around the defect. All right, so that was the result of the volume. Now let's talk a little bit about the action. The first challenge in evaluating the action is to understand the shape of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch in this geometry. We have these blue cones, which are the part of the Wheeler-DeWitt patch, which is simply an empty ADS. But then we have an extension in the region of the defect in green. And these are simply light cones, which start at the antipolar points where the defect where the brain meets the boundary. Right, and these two cones basically meet to form this tent-like shape that you see in the picture. And I should also say that these green chunks are portions of an entangling wedge of a region whose Ryu Takayanagi surface includes this tiny chunk, and so their expansion vanishes. All right, so in evaluating the action, we have a region with null boundaries. We have to be careful. We have to include a number of different contributions. One is the Einstein-Hilbert term. Then we have extrinsic curvature terms, the Gibbons Hawking York boundary term. Then we have codimension two joints. And then there are special contributions which are associated with the null surfaces. These are for the null surfaces, and this one is for null codimension two joints, which involve null surfaces. And in particular, notice that here, in order to render the contribution of null surfaces reparametrization invariant, we have to add what's called the counter term. And this counter term introduces a certain scale which mimics the effect of the reference scale in the definition of complexity. All right, so these are the, now this is in our setup. Basically, we have to look at all the contributions. There are many, many of them. And we have to evaluate them, including all the null contributions. But because we have, so the understanding is that it's a bit similar to when you evaluate entanglement. You're not trying to make, our understanding is that these divergences are in it. I mean, you could, of course, if you're only interested in the coefficient of the log, regularize it, but the standard practice is not to add counter terms to make it finite, like for the entanglement entropy, because these divergences are in a sense real. You really need to work very hard to introduce the correlations up to short length scale and so on. Like the state is really very entangled, and so usually you look at the structure of divergences as telling you, in a sense, something, at least the volume law, the area law, you attach to them some meaning. Right. Right, so these are the different contributions, but since we have a defect, we also need to include the defect contribution in the action. And that's what we did, and of course also a discontinuity in the Einstein-Hilbert term because there is a jump when we jump across the two sides of the defect. And this is what we get. So that, doing it carefully all the contributions, we get this for the bulk term, this for the surface and joint terms, and this for the defect contribution. But a miracle happens when we add them all together, the defect influence completely cancels out, and we are left with the result which is identical to the result of the vacuum, which includes, of course, this volume law measured in terms of in units of the cutoff, proportional to the central charge, and a constant contribution, but no memory of the fact that there was a defect here. So just recapping, if you take something from this talk, that's what you should remember. You should remember that when we evaluate in the presence of the defect the volume proposal, we find that the defect contributes a logarithmic term that is related to the boundary entropy. And when we evaluate the action, the defect influence simply cancels out. And so these results are very, very different from each other. So this setup can serve us to see the difference between the two proposals. All right, so,
Sorry, it seemed like these calculations are sensitive on how you regulate the theory.
No, so the coefficient of the log is not, I mean, it's true that the leading coefficient, if you multiply the cutoff by 2, will shift, but the coefficient of the log, of course, is not sensitive to that.
So the claim you just made about the difference between the two schemes, independent of how you regulate.
Right.
Previous slide. No, but it's mine.
No?
It's mine.
This one?
Yeah. So you did have that log divergence if you would have only considered the bulk term.
Yes, right. You didn't have a log divergence if you only considered the bulk term. That's right. Yes. I mean, you could have, in principle, things that would be, you know, log of the boundary size over the cutoff, but this don't appear in this setup. It doesn't mean that they don't appear in, say, higher dimensions. I think it's just due to the fact that it's a little bit like the entanglement. It jumps in powers of 2. And so the logs are going to appear in odd boundary dimensions for the complexity.
No, but I just meant, like, if you would have to consider the first line.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
For some recent, like, let's say, proposal, like,
right,
the
right.
Part, then you would have gotten, the cutoff divergence.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So okay. If your proposal, if your exactly. Favorite proposal.
Yeah, well, we can propose whatever.
Yes. Yeah, so if your favorite proposal is the, it has a name, your proposal, you know? It's called the complexity equals volume 2.0. It was proposed by a group at Texas. Right. All right. Any more questions? No. Okay. So the next thing we did, since we already had all this nice setup, is that we studied also complexity of subregions. So far I was talking only about complexity of pure states, but of course we can also define complexity for mixed states, which are associated with a given density matrix of a certain subregion of the boundary. And one approach is to define this as, on the field theory side, as the complexity of purification. So to ask what's the optimal way of building a purification, the closest possible purification of our mixed state. And in holography, there are, again, two versions of these proposals for the complexity of mixed states associated with subregions of the boundary. And both proposals are motivated by the understanding that the physics of a given subregion is encoded in its entanglement wedge due to all these people. So these are the two versions for subregions. The subregion complexity equals volumes suggests that the complexity is proportional to the maximal volume enclosed between the boundary subregion and the Ryu-Takayanagi surface of the boundary subregion, so basically this region in blue. And the subregion complexity equals action suggests that the complexity is given by the action of a region in the bulk that is bounded on one side by the entanglement wedge, and on the other side by the Wheeler-DeWitt patch. So we took our setup and evaluated these two proposals. We started with the subregion complexity equals volume. In order to do that, we need to find the volume enclosed in the Ryu-Takayanagi surface. And to do that, we first have to find the Ryu-Takayanagi surface. The way to match it across the defect is to minimize the total length, or there is an equivalent local condition. But basically, what it tells us is that the value of the coordinate R, where the two RT surfaces meet, is simply the average of the values of R where the RT surface meets the boundary. And then we evaluated the volume, and that's what we got. So again, a leading divergence, which is a volume law, and a subleading divergence, which depends on the tension of the brain, as well as a number of finite contributions, which depend on the boundary points and this topological contribution again. Since we already had the solution, we also used it to evaluate the entanglement entropy of this interval when it's not centered around the defect. So it was done previously for an interval which is centered exactly around the defect, where it's simply related to a boundary question by a folding trick. When you look at such intervals, you see that when the defect is exactly in the middle, this vanishes. This vanishes, and then the contribution is exactly the Diaflack-Ludwig boundary entropy. But when you turn, when the interval is asymmetric around the defect, there is some dependence on the boundary points. All right. So that's for the volume. Now for the action. So here there are a zoo of 22 contributions, and you can imagine that Dongsheng had great fun evaluating them all. And so what we did was to focus on the symmetric case because it really became very complicated. But we found again the same thing happening, which was that the logarithmic term did not depend on the, or that basically nothing depended on the defect. So the defect was not sensed by this measure. I should say that in the subregion case, there is an extra log divergence in addition to the leading contribution, which is the volume term. Okay, so this is everything that I wanted to tell you about holography. The last thing I wanted to tell you was a simple model that we did in field theory to study the influence of defects on the complexity. You already know that we are able in simple free bosonic models to evaluate the complexity. And so we did that in a simple model of a periodic domain with two defect points on opposite ends. The way to make this defect conformal, so to basically maintain as much as possible from the symmetry, is to match the two scalar fields on the two sides with a transfer matrix that depends on a parameter lambda. So that's what we did. And we assumed that the formula that was derived for the complexity of Gaussian states in free bosonic theory still applies here. This formula, if you remember, used the spectrum of the scalar. And so what we did here was simply to evaluate the spectrum of the scalar and plug it in this formula to see what we get. Right, and so that's the spectrum. We took a setup in which we have two different transfer matrices on the two opposite ends. I will tell you in a second what happens when they are related. But this is the result. So you get basically a complexity which has, again, a volume term and a leading term which depends on the scale of the reference state, a subleading logarithmic term, but that does not depend at all on the properties of the defect, and a constant term which depends on the parameters of the defect. If you think about a compact scalar, then these transfer parameters are related to the ratio of the radii of the scalars, and in particular, from consistency, they have to be the inverse of one another at the opposite points. And so when you take this particular condition and you put it in the formula for the complexity, you get that the complexity does not see the defect at all, at least in this simple model. In any event, the logarithmic contribution does not depend on the defects parameter, and so we are trying to claim that this, at least in this setup, favors the complexity equals action proposal. Right, one thing that we did not do carefully, but we would like to do in the future, is to think about the influence of zero modes, since we know that when studying entanglement of a compact boson, this, say, zero mode contributions are important, and so they could be, in principle, also important for the complexity, but we did not yet get the chance to think about that carefully. All right, so let me summarize. So we saw this new tool, which was the complexity, a new tool from quantum information that can teach us more about quantum states. And we explored the two holographic duals to the complexity. Previous tests have given identical or very similar results for both proposals. However, for defects, at least in this ADS3 setup, we get very different results for the volume and the action. And so that can be used, can be seen as a useful tool to distinguish the two proposals. And there are, of course, many, many future directions. I think perhaps our conclusion at the moment is still premature, since ADS3 is known to be special in various circumstances. And so in order to conclude definitely that the complexity equals action is favored, we would have to go to higher dimension and see the same effect there. We would like to think about other holographic defects, the Janus solution, for example. Think about different codimension defects, asymmetric defects. These were always symmetric at the two opposite ends of the periodic domain, or antipodal. Zero modes, I already mentioned. And of course, I think you all maybe sense that the big question here when studying complexity is to define it properly in conformal field theory, so that we can really compare the holographic models not to simple toy models in free theories, but to the real thing. So I think that's going to be the next step of this community. And that's it. So there's lots to explore. And thanks.
Any questions? Oh, there. Okay, hold on.
So in your last slide, you had a free theory computation. But I thought you want to put your theory on ADS2. Does it make a difference?
If we put the free theory on ADS2?
Yes.
I mean, I think that's not, I mean, yeah, I don't know of any results that deal with the with complexity in curved backgrounds on the field theory side. Yeah, I think it's interesting to explore, but in any event, that's not what you would expect to happen. I think on the boundary of the model that we are studying, which would just be like a simple cylinder.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
I'm not sure if it's worth it, but there's the just hopping fermion or hopping free model,
uh-huh,
where you have lattice model, but you modulate your coupling, so you don't have a translational invariant system, which does realize in the continuum limit the ADS2 background, and it's known as rainbow chain. Ground state is exactly known, so maybe you can compute complexity some way.
That sounds interesting. Maybe we can discuss after.
Any other questions? If not, thank Shira again.